Welcome to the Holistic Psychiatry Podcast. I'm Courtney Snyder, a physician and holistic adult and child psychiatrist. In this episode, I'll be discussing our genetic variants and the genes they code for and how this can translate to brain-related symptoms. I'll talk about the role of methylation and oxidative stress in gene expression, the types of protein that are especially important in brain health, examples of these variants and how they can impact neurotransmitter functioning and thus create symptoms. Psychiatric symptoms such as depression, anxiety, mood swings, brain fog, hyperactivity, and psychosis are not caused by a specific gene. Instead, certain genes, or rather certain gene variants, raise our vulnerability to developing brain-related symptoms. We each have well over 1,000 genetic variants, or what are called SNPs. Most of these we'll never hear from unless they are expressed. Oxidative stress, which can impact this expression, is when our antioxidant system is overwhelmed by things like toxins, high inflammatory states, trauma, and/or other insults. Most people with brain-related symptoms are dealing with some oxidative stress. In fact, the brain is a good barometer of oxidative stress. The expression of our genetic variants is also impacted by methylation, a chemical reaction in which a small molecule, or a methyl group, is added to DNA, proteins, or other molecules. Our ability to methylate, which is very important for our health, is impacted by a number of genes. These genes can also have variants. Aside from supporting our physiology by lowering and preventing oxidative stress, it is also important that we optimize methylation. Each of our genes make a protein. Having a variant on a gene means that protein may not work as well. There are different types of proteins with different jobs. I'll list the types of proteins that are especially relevant in brain health. The first being enzymes. These speed up chemical reactions in the body. They can be involved in making neurotransmitters, metabolizing or removing neurotransmitters, turning one neurotransmitter into another. They're involved in methylation and detoxification. Another example of a protein especially relevant in brain health are receptors. Neurotransmitters allow one nerve cell to communicate with another. The nerve cell releases neurotransmitters that bind to receptors on the next nerve cell. This results in a change in the receptor, which causes an electrical signal to travel down that nerve cell to then communicate to the next. Another example of a protein are reuptake receptors. These are also receptors at the synapse, the space between the cells, that take up the neurotransmitter, such as serotonin reuptake receptors, which are especially important. In fact, SSRIs block these receptors so that more serotonin is available. Another example of a protein is ion channels. These are involved in the movement of ions, so sodium and potassium, across nerve cell membranes. This causes an electrical impulse to travel away from the synapse, that space between the nerve cells, and down the long nerve cell to the next synapse. We also have storage proteins. The best example, and the one that I think of most commonly in psychiatry, is metallothionein. These are proteins that play an important role in the detoxification of toxic metals and regulate copper-zinc levels. We also have transport proteins. These carry things around in the blood, such as trace metals or hormones. One example is ceruloplasmin, a protein that binds copper. If this ceruloplasmin is relatively low, we can have free and unbound copper that is high and thus causing symptoms. So regarding neurotransmitter activity, we can have a lot of a particular neurotransmitter, but if we have very few receptors for it to bind to on the next nerve cell, we can have symptoms. Too many reuptake receptors, which I just mentioned, could mean more neurotransmitter is being picked up at the synapse and then less is available to bind to the receptor. This too could cause symptoms. And in fact, high serotonin reuptake receptors resulting in low serotonin activity is a common cause of depression. And so this is one of the reasons that I use the term neurotransmitter activity instead of just suggesting that a neurotransmitter is high or low. This is also one of the reasons many of us don't find measuring neurotransmitters or their metabolites particularly useful. So just to review briefly the more common neurotransmitters that we think of in psychiatry, serotonin is involved in giving us joy, a sense of well-being and pleasure, interest, restful sleep. If there is low activity, we can have depressed and anxious mood, lack of enjoyment, difficulty falling and staying asleep. Dopamine is involved in pleasure and reward. Low activity could result in low motivation, difficulty starting and finishing tasks, low stress tolerance, social isolation, helplessness, and hopelessness. High activity could result in worry, insomnia, brain fog, paranoia, mania, and even psychosis. Norepinephrine is involved in arousal. Low activity can contribute to depression and fatigue. High activity can contribute to nervousness and insomnia. GABA is a major inhibitory neurotransmitter, so it kind of puts on the brakes. It is involved in calming and rest. When it is low, or when there is low activity, there can be anxiety, high inner tension, and feelings of overwhelm. Glutamate is the major excitatory neurotransmitter in the brain. It is involved in learning, memory, and mood regulation. If there is excessive glutamate, we can have overexcitation in the brain and even cell death. Histamine is actually a neurotransmitter and is involved in sleep and wakefulness. Too much can cause brain fog, headaches, nervousness, sleep disturbance, and fatigue. Acetylcholine plays an important role in learning, memory, and attention. Low activity contributes to problems with memory, word finding, learning, new information, and brain fog. So I'm going to list examples of genes that code for proteins that impact brain health. And I'll do this in my typical format of 10. And the first five are the ones that I think about most often when I'm evaluating someone for treatment or doing a consultation. The next five that I'll list will be those that I don't find as clinically relevant, but they're worth mentioning just to illustrate the complexities of the number of genes that are impacting our brain. Some of these variants can be identified with genetic testing. Some of these genes will appear to be impacted. However, a specific location on that gene has either not been identified or there are so many possible locations that genetic testing isn't particularly useful. So first are genes involved in methylation. So from a Walsh perspective, and I have a lot of information on my website and in these newsletters about the Walsh Research Institute, we look at methylation as happening on a spectrum from undermethylation to overmethylation, with optimal methylation being in between. So methylation is determined by a balance of a number of genes, not just MTHFR, which you'll often hear about. So in the newsletter, I show a diagram from Amy Yasko's site called the Simplified Methylation Pathway. And you'll see that this is quite a complex process that is involving multiple cycles, each with various genes. So methylation impacts the expression of many of our other genes, as I said. However, it also plays a very big role in neurotransmitter functioning. Most people with brain conditions have a methylation imbalance, with undermethylation being much more common. Those who are undermethylated and have depression or anxiety more often will have an excessive amount of folate. This impacts how tightly wound our DNA is, and how tightly wound our DNA is can result, in this case, in an increased expression of those serotonin reuptake receptors, which lower serotonin in the synapse and thus worsen depression. So in overmethylation, we see the opposite effect. In the newsletter, also show a diagram from the Walsh Research Institute, which shows genes that tend us in the direction of undermethylation and those that tend us in the direction of overmethylation. Number two are enzymes that metabolize or get rid of catecholamines. COMT has frequent variants, and this is an enzyme that codes for catechol-O-methyltransferase, an enzyme that metabolizes catecholamines. So catecholamines are dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine. It also breaks down estrogen. So a slow COMT could mean a buildup of catecholamines, especially when we're under stress, and this can cause high anxiety. It's also worth mentioning that though variants can create weaknesses on enzymes, so can other factors. So for example, high estrogen states, which a slow COMT can cause, will also further slow a COMT. A fast COMT can result in catecholamines being cleared too quickly. So this could result in cravings, addictive tendencies, and excessive sleepiness. MAOA is another enzyme that metabolizes catecholamines and can be slow or fast in its functioning. However, it also metabolizes serotonin and histamine and does not metabolize estrogen. Number three, enzymes that break down histamine. A variant in one or more of these genes could cause high histamine states. So DAO, which codes for diamine oxidase, is an enzyme that breaks down histamine in food. So people that have a weakness here could have problems with high histamine foods. HNMT codes for histamine and methyltransferase, an enzyme that breaks down histamine in cells. MAOA codes for monoamine oxidase again, and is an enzyme that breaks down histamine, tyramine, and as mentioned, catecholamines. Methylation genes, of which MTHFR is the main player, collectively impact our body's ability to break down histamine. So again, you can see methylation is involved in the expression of genes, in the expression of certain receptors, the breakdown of histamine, and detoxification. So number four are proteins involved in metal detoxification. MT genes code for metallothionines, which are proteins involved in metal detoxification and the regulation of copper and zinc, among other things. The epigenetic expression of the gene for metallothionines is dependent on the presence of zinc. Though we don't have an identifiable SNP, a weakness in this gene can be evidenced in families with high copper conditions and suspected in individuals who have especially high copper levels. High copper is common in ADHD, anxiety, angry outbursts, postpartum depression, as well as other hormonally related brain symptoms. Number five, enzyme involved in cortisol production. 21-hydroxylase is an enzyme that helps produce cortisol, which is needed to maintain blood sugar, protect the body from stress, and suppress inflammation. A weakness in this gene, of which there could be many and not easily identified, can result in inflammation, including brain inflammation when under stress. While there are many other enzymes involved in hormonal pathways, I would rank this one as the most important, fitting with RCCX theory, which I've previously discussed. A weakness in this gene is thought to be very common in psychiatric disorders and other complex chronic health conditions, such as chronic inflammatory response syndrome, electromagnetic hypersensitivity, mast cell activation, and chronic fatigue. I share these next five proteins not because they're on the forefront of my mind, as these first five are, but because they speak to the further complexities of how our variants can impact our brain. So number six are enzymes that turn one neurotransmitter into another. So GAD1 codes for glutamate decarboxylase, an enzyme that breaks down glutamate, which is anxiety-inducing, into GABA, which is calming. A variant at GAD1 could result in too much excitatory glutamate and too little GABA. Number seven, receptors for neurotransmitters. There are many genes that directly code for the many types of receptors. One example are the genes that code for dopamine receptors. So this is DRD1 all the way through DRD5. Number 8, complement, or C4. This is an interesting protein which is part of the complement system, which is found on certain cells within our plasmas and involved in immunity and autoimmunity. But separately, C4 variants have been associated with a higher likelihood of schizophrenia, seemingly because it controls for synaptic pruning that normally happens during development. So synaptic pruning would be the removal of some of these neuronal connections. This is part of normal development. However, it's a process that needs to be in check, so too much or too little could be problematic. This idea of pruning is also being implicated in autism, where it's felt that in early development there's not enough pruning and excessive neuronal connections. Number 9, enzymes involved in detoxification. As mentioned, oxidative stress plays a role in mental health and in the expression of our variants. There are many, many enzymes involved in both phase 1, which is the cytochrome P450 genes, and phase 2, detoxification. Methylation is involved in detoxification as well. And lastly, and I would say actually least, and I don't find this gene particularly useful, but I mention it because it's certainly talked about a lot, which is the HLA-DR gene, which is often referred to as the dreaded gene. I mention this because many people believe this is important when it comes to mold toxicity, a common cause of brain symptoms. And I, like my mentor, Dr. Neil Nathan, who I would say is really a pioneer in the field of mold toxicity, has not found this gene to be useful in predicting who will have mold toxicity, the severity of their symptoms, or in their prognosis. This dreaded gene, however, does create a lot of stress, and this is not something that I would test for. So lastly, how can we support these genes so they can do their best work? We can lower oxidative stress, and that's much of what I talk about in other episodes when we talk about addressing inflammation, addressing toxicity, supporting our autonomic nervous system, lowering inflammation, lowering chronic stress, addressing trauma, improving our attachment experiences. We can also support methylation. And we can more specifically support the enzymes or proteins that don't appear to be working up to speed. In an upcoming newsletter, I'll discuss how specific targeted nutrients can promote the synthesis and functioning of some of these enzymes and proteins that I've discussed. And I'll also talk about how they can be used to address this oxidative stress. In this week's paid newsletter, I'll be applying this information using specific case examples with family histories. Thank you for listening. If you are interested in receiving this podcast with text and audio in your mailbox each week, please consider subscribing at CourtneySnyderMD.com or on Substack. Until next time, take care.